And yeah, I think they probably have a reservoir of books that we keep putting out. They have a lot of volunteers and a lot of activity going on there already. Speaking of activity, downtown Urbana by the Champaign County Courthouse at 11 o'clock, there is another rally. This one's by CURE. And I have some text here about it that I should have in front of me. Maybe I'll play this underwriting announcement and get back with you on the latest rally against Trump. It's not a no king's hook, which is a good one. You know, they gave him a crown in Korea, isn't that? They know how to curry him. A lot of gold leaf involved, too.
This hour of programming is brought to you by Cranor Center for the Performing Arts and the listeners of WEFT. November at Cranor Center features the play Burnout Paradise on November 7th and 8th. Guitarist Khaki King with her family-friendly multimedia presentation Bugs on November 15th. And East meets West Fusion with Sunny Jane's Wild Wild East on November 20th. Complete information is available at cranordcenter.com.
Okay. We like the support from the cultural organization. The rally, Start the Change. This is, it's a year, roughly, to the next general election. So, the Champaign-Urbana resistance effort is calling people to start the change. Live music and a number of local speakers. I know that Claudia Lenhoff of the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers is going to be on the podium. Perhaps Julie Pride from the Public Health District. And, well, go by and see. That's 11 to noon. I'll be scooting by after the show. So, got another event tomorrow at the IMC that I'll go into in a little further detail, and that's a memorial for the late, great Eminence Grease of the IMC, Belden Fields. There's a special issue that's still available, articles about him. We're hoping to present a lot of the articles that he wrote. He wrote something like 80 articles in 20 years, which is really great. Okay, I said I was going to put a sock in it and play the stuff. And late breaking, I have another Mumia Abu-Jamal. Regrettably, I don't have an update on his health needs. He is having eye problems. He's gotten some treatment for some of the other chronic ailments. Prison is full of chronic ailments, and the health care is not great. Better it is on the outside, though that's crumbling too. And apparently there were two lawsuits about the SNAP benefits and the money that he did release to the SNAP funding last time he had a record-breaking shutdown in his first term that he's refusing to do this time. Two judges have said, just do it. Dean Baker had a great, great spiel on him just there. If you didn't hear that, that's from the alternating show, Counterspin. Okay, I didn't do a real rundown. Got Dennis Bernstein with Greg Palast. It's partially on voting issues. Nuclear Hot Seat. Dynamite Room. There's a new film out by Catherine Bigelow. I'm not a big cultural movie person. Something like that. I'm not a filmophile. That's a word. But apparently it's about nuclear confrontation and has annoyed the Pentagon. So if she's annoyed the Pentagon with this film, then I'm happy. And people are using it around the country to talk about the threat of nuclear weapons. We've had this saber-rattling this week from Trump talking about testing nuclear weapons. And I thought it was like just his confusion of the nuclear-powered cruise missile, which I guess could also be called a loft all-the-time drone, since with a nuke micro-reactor, you could have it flying around forever at low levels under the radar. Isn't that a great concept? Interesting that NanoNuclear, the company that's the U of I is working with to put a micro-reactor on campus on Oak Street by the Abbott Power Plant, has gotten the Air Force contract. So I guess maybe the Air Force wants to have a micro-reactor dirigible. Actually, that's just a joke because I always like to drop dirigibles into my conversation. But anyway, a micro-reactor-powered drone is probably what Nano is going to make for the Air Force while they're busy also trying to get the kinks out of their micro-reactor, which hasn't been built before. It's an experiment. It's going to be happening in our town. They could at least do it somewhere else and truck it in if it's so nice and portable and modular. And here I promised I wasn't going to get on a rant, but here I am ranting. Here's Mumia Abu-Jamal remembering Elder.
Muhammad Ahmad and the Black Freedom Struggle. His name is Muhammad Ahmad. And if this name doesn't ring a bell, well, don't be surprised, for it indicates how media has supported the civil rights movement while ignoring and downplaying the Black liberation movement. Dr. Muhammad Ahmad, a celebrated scholar activist, has had a long and impressive history as a member of RAM, the Revolutionary Action Movement, the chairman of the African People's Party, APP, and for over 5 years, a Black political prisoner in Philadelphia, New York City, and San Diego, California. He supported the pre-Newton formations of the Black Panther Party, a group mostly based on the East Coast, as well as the Republic of New Africa, RNA, which fought for the separation of 5 southern states for Black settlement as a land base for an independent Black nation. RAM, which operated in Philadelphia and New York City, named Robert Williams, formerly of the NAACP chapter in Monroe, North Carolina, its president in exile, while Williams lived in Cuba and later China. Dr. Muhammad Ahmad's own book, which I believe was titled Look for Me in the Whirlwind, is a delightful telling of him growing up in West Philadelphia, where the now legendary figure, Queen Mother Moore, became one of his teachers and allowed him to use her extensive library for study and research. Dr. Ahmad taught for years at Temple and lived more history than is often written in books. We applaud him for his significant role in our freedom struggle for freedom and independence for Black people. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Again, Books to Prisoners sale from 9 to 5 today. Let's go on with Amy's piece. This is related to electoral issues. She's got chapter and verse about this representative in the special election in, is it Arizona or New Mexico? Listen to her. One thing that she doesn't mention here is I think one of the other things they're worried about with the Epstein what is it called? It's not a consent decree. It's a discharge petition that enough people sign a petition, they can put something on the table without going through the Speaker of the House, who is an idiot just like Trump, maybe worse. They could be worried that this discharge petition might catch on, and they might do some other things for discharge petition, like maybe continuing the subsidy of people buying their health insurance, that sort of thing, SNAP benefits, so it isn't just a half measure, or any number of things that maybe MTG and some other people could get on. She's on board on the Epstein release. Will they ever release anything about the intelligence connections and the money laundering that Epstein was involved with? It was much more money than it would be just trafficking commodities like young women. I think that's part of what Trump is worried about, because I think he was in bed, quote unquote, with Epstein on money laundering. So anyway, one can hope.
Speaker Johnson, seat Adelita Grijalva now. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. As the United States government shutdown marks its fifth week, approaching the record 35-day shutdown set back in 2018-19, unleashing a worsening cascade of hardship, one explanation for the shutdown comes from longtime Republican strategist turned Never Trump activist Stuart Stevens of the Lincoln Project, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour last week.
Say what you will about Jeffrey Epstein, the guy's dead and he can still shut down Congress.
What does the child sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, who according to the official record died by suicide inside his prison cell in 2019, have to do with a government shutdown in late 2025? The answer comes from Tucson, Arizona, and Congressmember-elect Adelita Grijalva, who recently won a special election to fill the House seat left vacant by the death of her father, longtime progressive Democratic Congressmember Raul Grijalva. Adelita Grijalva won the special election on September 23rd as a representative of Arizona's 7th Congressional District, representing Tucson. Despite her election, though, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson has refused to swear her in more than a month after her victory. His obstruction of this essential, constitutionally mandated function of our democracy is without precedent. President Trump is profoundly afraid that the contents of the government's Jeffrey Epstein files will see the light of day. Trump's name reportedly appears in the files numerous times. There's currently a bipartisan discharge petition in the House of Representatives, which would force the release of the Epstein files. It needs 218 votes to pass. When Adelita Grijalva is sworn into Congress, she has vowed she will be that deciding vote, directing the Department of Justice, quote, to make publicly available certain records related to Jeffrey Epstein or Ghislaine Maxwell, unquote, Epstein's co-conspirator, currently serving a 20-year sentence in federal prison. Why else would Johnson so blatantly violate his duty and refuse to swear in Grijalva, other than to protect Donald Trump from whatever is contained in the Epstein files? What's shocking is that release of the files was a major pledge Trump made during his presidential campaign.
And as soon as this administration is in office, all of a sudden there's nothing to see here. And the American people want to know what is in those files, who's implicated, and the victims need an opportunity for justice and a voice.
Said Congressmember-elect Adelita Grijalva on Democracy Now! 2 weeks after winning her election. While Grijalva waits, ready to be sworn in to begin formally representing her 800,000-plus constituents, more and more Republicans are growing frustrated with the government shutdown and with Speaker Johnson's intransigence on keeping the House of Representatives out of session. California Republican Kevin Kiley insisted on CNN Wednesday the House should immediately get back to work, then responded to a question about Johnson's refusal to swear in Grijalva.
She won her election. She deserves to be sworn in. That district deserves a representative. And we were supposed to be in session, by the way, right after she was elected. And we were supposed to be in session the next week and the next week after that. So the fact that we haven't had session isn't anything that she's responsible for. And by the way, even if we were out of session, as we have been, she could still be sworn in during what's called a pro forma session, where basically we just gavel in, say the prayer, say the pledge, and gavel out every 4 days as required by the Constitution. Members have been sworn in pro forma sessions like that before. So I absolutely think she should be sworn in. I don't understand why this is even an issue.
Grijalva and Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays have taken Speaker Johnson to court, suing him, along with the House clerk and its sergeant at arms, demanding she be sworn in. The complaint states, quote, prior to the election of Ms. Grijalva, every time a special election has been conducted during Mr. Johnson's tenure as Speaker of the House, the winner has been sworn in immediately upon unofficial notification of the results, unquote. And notes that among those quickly sworn in by Johnson were Celeste Molloy, Vince Fong, Jimmy Patronis, and Randy Fine, all Republicans, and in September, Democrat James Walkinshaw of Virginia. The suit also argues Johnson's delay is based on Grijalva's expected vote on the Epstein Files discharge petition. All this time during the government shutdown, while members of the House are getting paid for not showing up to Congress, more than a million federal workers deemed essential, like TSA workers and air traffic controllers, are forced to work without pay. As Trump exerts maximum pressure to block the release of the Epstein files, and after literally demolishing the East Wing of the White House, traditionally the First Lady's domain, and paving over the Rose Garden, first planted by First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy, Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva's voice and vote is needed in Congress now. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay. Going to keep moving here. Let's hear Greg Palast. Dennis Bernstein is calling this the election crimes bulletin, but or something like that. But actually, it's the first 10 minutes or so is about Venezuela, close to Greg Palast's heart. He did a film about the coup against Chavez. Was down there when it was happening, or one of them. Yeah. I always like to mention that SAIC, which used to be brick and mortar in town, and probably still has some employees, was involved in sabotaging the oil industry in Venezuela. One of those coup attempts. They didn't take kindly to it being being nationalized.
Starting in Venezuela, this is the Election Crimes Bulletin, international, national, and local. Give us your understanding with all your experience in terms of the what you think is happening here, where those boats that the United States is sinking, extrajudicial murders mounting up over 57 now.
I always love that term, extrajudicial. We mean murder. And death squads. It's the death squads from, you know, an F-16. And this does, we're going to tie this back into elections both in the U.S. and Venezuela and around Latin America. Number one, okay, there's three things you have to know about Venezuela. And for those who know, I'm sure you introduced it. I was off the line for a minute. But, you know, for years I covered Venezuela for The Guardian and BBC Television and Trinidad, by the way, too. And the three things you have to know about Venezuela are, number one, Venezuela has the largest reserves of oil on the planet. And the second thing you have to know is that Venezuela has the largest reserves of oil on the planet. The three, same. It's about the oil. Believe it or not, I know that you never thought about the idea that oil has something to do with our foreign policy. But yes, and we're willing to kill for it. We have. We're willing to kill Americans for it, too. And that's what may be coming up next at the plate, the World Series of oil thievery. So you're talking about the nation with the largest reserves of oil on the planet, but because of an embargo that we've placed on the nation, we basically, it's an act of war. It's a siege in which parts and anything that can keep the oil industry in Venezuela going is blocked. And Venezuela's sales of oil is blocked. Their OPEC quota, and they can go higher now, is 2.4 million barrels of oil a day. And they're only producing one-fourth of that because of this embargo. So, of course, they're broke. And when people are broke, they don't like the government. So, I don't have any doubt that Maduro lost the last election. He shoplifted it, much as Trump, as we've talked about this, shoplifted 2024 through manipulation. Now, I knew Hugo Chavez very well. If you go to gregpalace.com, you'll see my films and my talks with Chavez for BBC. Chavez was wildly popular, and he won by massive amounts because I went out with him, and I also knew his opposition, Julio Borges, a decent guy, but there's no question. I go into a town, two people would show up for the Chavez opposition, and then 2,000 would show up when Chavez would arrive the next week. So Chavez was democratically elected, Maduro not so, but that's not what this is about. After all, think about it. You know, we're all shaken up about there's a lack of democracy in Venezuela, as opposed to what, Saudi Arabia? The Emirates? Are you kidding me? These are just dictators in bathrobes in the Mideast. And so so what's happening here now with these boats? First of all, I know Trinidad and Venezuela. They're 7 miles apart. It's like in Los Angeles going to Catalina, which is 26 miles away. People commute to work, especially Trinidadians going to. And we know two young men were murdered in one boat. And the Trinidad president of Trinidad is a huge Trump fan, just so you know. She loves Trump. But she did say, you did kill two of our citizens who were doing nothing but coming home from work in these little boats that go across 7 miles. Now, little Marco Rubio, our Secretary of State and NSA chair, said that the boats were going to Trinidad, a couple of miles off Venezuela shore. Nothing about drugs. And then he heard Trump say, no, they're heading to Miami. It's like going to Miami in a rowboat. It's not going to, I'm laughing because these people got killed, but it's so ridiculous. It's literally laughable, tragically laughable. So these boats leaving from the Venezuelan shore to go to Trinidad were being blown up. There were 11 people in the first boat. If you have these little open, and I've seen the boat, it's typical. The Trinidadians used to call them vomit rockets because of the waves between Venezuela and Trinidad. They're commuters. And 11 people in the boat. You don't have 11 drug dealers in a boat to move some supposedly fentanyl or whatever they're supposed to be moving. So it's literally slaughtering people, mostly Trinidadians. And now there were some boats that were actually blown up in the Pacific, submersibles and others, which were undoubtedly drug dealers. But none of the U.S. mainstream media, as far as I could tell, were identifying those boats as not coming from Venezuela, because Venezuela doesn't have there's no shoreline in the Pacific. And that's where drug boats go. They don't go across. For obvious reasons, they don't go across the Mediterranean. So it's very important to understand this is a provocation. It has nothing to do with drugs. In fact, if we wanted to get drugs, there is the Kinahan organized crime group identified by Interpol and the FBI as the number one drug-moving organization for cocaine, which is supposedly was coming in from Venezuela, fentanyl. They are based in Abu Dhabi. And now, why don't they go after Abu Dhabi if that's where the coke is coming from or being organized from the Kinahan gang? It may have to do with, there's a 747 gift given to Trump, not to America, but to Trump, $2 billion from the Emirates to buy Trump's crypto coin, which pretty much goes in his pocket and his family, $2 billion. And maybe that has something to do with not going after Abu Dhabi, but going after Venezuela. And the idea that, I mean, the United Nations annual drug report says basically there's no fentanyl coming out of Venezuela. I mean, what drug dealer would move their stuff through Venezuela, which is being watched? It's as ridiculous as Trump's claim that Canada was a major source of fentanyl. The major source of fentanyl in the United States, by the way, is New Jersey. Okay, so, you might go after New Jersey, too. You never know.
Yes. Yeah, you never know. That's Greg Palace.
It's about, yes. Go ahead, sorry.
I just just to let people know, you're listening to Flashpoint's Greg Pallister. We're reinstituting our election crimes bulletin because it's going to be a battle for elections all over this country and around the world. This is a new world order, and the fight for the free vote is going to get that much more intense. So we do this report every week with Greg, and we're happy to have him. Greg, you know, before we jump into the domestic side of this discussion, we are being told, and it's verifiable, it's pretty believable, that there were between 4 and 6 million Venezuelans ready to meet the Americans at the shore and fight. It doesn't seem like Trump is up for that one, but this could get pretty messy, and it could easily spill over into domestic politics, right? Do you want to say a little bit about
this?
First
of all, yes. Number one, okay, this is the fourth attempt to overthrow the government of Venezuela, three times going after, twice after Chavez, twice after Maduro. Chavez was kidnapped with the U.S. State Department's help. Back in 2002, that's when I was assigned by BBC to go down there. I'd been tipped off that the coup was going to happen. And Chavez was kidnapped with our government approval. And while he was kidnapped, they had an inauguration. It was like a Jean Genet play where they had these fake guys inaugurate Exxon's lawyer. I can't make this up. Exxon's lawyer is president, chosen by civil society. But what they – and they thought, oh, the people will be so happy that we got rid of Chavez. Well, a couple hundred thousand people came down from the ranchos, the poor neighborhoods of Venezuela, and surrounded the presidential palace. And so the guys inside, the fake president, Exxon's lawyer, et cetera, he took off his sash and they took off and they fled. And again, it was like another Bay of Pigs. If we go back in now, it'll be another Bay of Pigs because Venezuelans, even those who don't like Maduro, and most don't, by the way, but they do like their nation. They're patriots and they are armed. Every Venezuelan has a gun and they're Americans are going to die. Venezuelans, yes, but if America, if Trump sends in our troops, they're going to die on those beaches. And again, once again, according to the Wall Street Journal, they have a plan to kidnap Maduro. This is the second time they're trying this kidnap game. Won't be so easy this time, or kill him. And understand, this is all, and here's where it comes back to elections. Chavez was certainly elected, and I'm looking at a document that was marked secret from the FBI, where the FBI hired the company ChoicePoint. Now, if you listen to my stories, read my books, ChoicePoint is the company that purged the voter rolls of Florida in 2000 of so-called black felons, black men who supposedly committed crimes and couldn't vote. Not one was an illegal voter, but this company, ChoicePoint, picked these guys out. They removed 58,000 black men from the voter rolls, and Trump, and Bush won by just 537 votes. So they weren't happy with just stealing the election in the U.S. They hired ChoicePoint to steal the voter files of Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, Honduras, and Venezuela. To play the same games that they did to steal the election in the United States, they brought it to South America. So you have to understand, they have been for decades to bend the elections in South America. And so the tricks that they were using about going to the voter files, purging voters, as they did in Florida, and as Trump is doing today through DOGE in an executive order, March 25th of this year, Trump ordered states to turn over their voter files to DOGE if DOGE requests it. And remember, we have to Voight and all these other guys. I mean, if you thought Musk was bad, the current leadership of DOGE is even more frightening. And they're going into our voter files to come up with ways to remove voters, you know, saying that there's double voters. That's a lot of guys named Jose Gonzalez are considered double voters because they find Jose Gonzalez in California, they find Jose Gonzalez in Texas, and they say, oh, it's got to be the same guy. Even if it's a different middle name, you know, it doesn't matter. Obviously, it's just some Mexican illegally voting and voting in two states. This is the games being played. So understand, we're going back to 2000, the same games played here, played in Latin America, and then it's coming back here again. This is dangerous stuff for our democracy and democracies throughout our hemisphere. There you go.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Greg Palast, it's our election crimes bulletin. We're going to be doing this every Tuesday, talking about the things that are coming up around voting, various issues, various structures being created every day, really. And people thinking all the time about how they are going to disenfranchise the vote in this country. We really have a big struggle ahead of us, don't we, Greg? And it seems that Trump is trying every way possible to get the military into the streets, to get people to be afraid to go out and vote. I mean, we've seen this on steroids since the last election.
Well, we had in 2024 in Atlanta, we had 36 polling stations, 36 polling stations in the black community in Atlanta were shut down because of bomb threats. So Venezuela is getting hit with it. America is getting hit with it. You think we're not a third world nation? Take a look. They're using the same tactics. And when we talk about potentially, literally, Trump has said, according to the Journal report, that he's going to assassinate Maduro. Now, where did this idea come from? Remember good old Pat Robertson, the televangelist? I have a half-hour streaming video I did for Democracy Now! Called The Assassination of Hugo Chavez. No, he wasn't assassinated. It was suggested by Pat Robertson on the air. He says, well, we've got hit squads. What are they for? Let's take out Hugo Chavez. It's easier than – and why did he want that? Because Pat Robertson – well, there's a lot of oil in Venezuela. Pat Robertson was – his money came from getting diamond mining concessions, and Chavez refused to give him a diamond mining concession, and that's why he wanted him knocked off, because there's diamonds, there's gold, and a whole lot of oil, 300 billion barrels of oil. And, you know, that's quite a bit to get your hands on. Exxon wants that oil back. They left Venezuela. Chevron wants to be able to pump that oil. And that's what this is all about. But it really comes back to America, because you can't get – Americans don't want to invade Venezuela, you can't have fair elections, because if there's a referendum in our midterms about whether we should go into another war, that would lose. So you have to mess with the voter files here, as you do in Venezuela, as you do in Argentina, as you do in Brazil.
Wow, that's a problem. So, you know, as Pete Seeger used to say, any 9 or 10 idiots, give them a sledgehammer and they could knock over a barn. But give the same folks a few tools and see if they can build one. Greg, is there a way, what's a vision for dealing with this, with trying to wrestle back the vote? What are the possibilities, and what's it going to look like if we lose?
Well, I've been working with Black Voters Matter Fund, Latasha Brown, with Gerald Griggs, NAACP, Jesse Jackson, and obviously Rainbow Push. And what is the strategy? And it's raising the alarm more than anything else. It is raising the alarm. And the number one way that they take your vote is not from, you know, Elon Musk sending spiders from outer space from his SpaceX or any of that stuff, but it is good old fashioned Jim Crow, where they take people in minority names, they flush them out of the polls. Under, in 2016, for those who recall and have been taking notes carefully over these years, I ran a campaign with Rainbow Push to end something, and Bernie Sanders, by the way, to end something called interstate cross-check, where they took names that were similar in two states, and they'd say, oh, that's a double voter. And again, it was a lot of Jose Garcias and Emilio Rodriguez's and a lot of Jesse Jackson's, actually, and James Brown. They removed 238 voters named James Brown, saying it was the same guy voting again and again. But we thought we had defeated it. When I say we, working with these groups, and then we brought in the ACLU, brought a lawsuit, federal court, and the system was shut down. It had cost just short of 1 million votes. That's the only way Trump got elected in 2016, by the way. That's the only reason he got elected. And but we thought we had defeated it.
Now, here's this week's featured interview.
That was a technical problem that they had at the station KPFA. That was the Election Crimes Bulletin, and that's how it ended. And I was trying to post something about the big early turnout at the Books to Prisoners sale at the IMC, 9 to 5 today, if you want to support their project in getting books into the hands of prisoners in Danville. They're talking about maybe working with some groups in Chicago to, because they've had a surplus of books here. Need more volunteers and money to mail and do the other things that are involved. It's quite an involving project. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock, there is a memorial for Belden Fields also at the IMC, so check your local listings. Let's get back to Libby Halevy and her nuclear hot seat program. I don't like the theme particularly, but it's too lighthearted on such a subject. She's actually an alumna of the U of I, it turns out. I've been corresponding with her a little bit, trying to get her to do something about the Price-Anderson Act, which limits liability for nuclear accidents. So the taxpayers, have to pay for the damage inflicted on us by possible accident. And, of course, I always remind people of the microreactor at the U of I campus. They had a celebration of the drilling. What curtailed drilling has to do? Well, they need water from the aquifer to cool their nuclear, micronuclear plant. It's not a very big one. It's cute. They could test it outside of town and drive it in. But then putting it by the railroad tracks where a train derailment might mess up the system. Anyway, some of that's chronicled in my article, and not the latest Public Eye, but the previous one. You can find it online. Also has a reference to Bruce Hannon's, the late Bruce Hannon's article, where he brought up the idea that you really want to put a nuclear plant next to a railroad track. Hadn't thought of it. Okay, let's hear Libby Halevy, and she's interviewing a fellow from Los Alamos Study Group, I guess it's called. I'll let her do the details. This was done before Trump started rattling the nuclear saber by saying that because Putin was testing this nuclear-powered cruise missile, which I've been calling an always-aloft drone, having a micro-reactor carrying munitions around flying in the sky all of the time. Well, that's what the world needs, more of those. And NanoNuclear, which is building the microreactor with the U of I, has got an Air Force contract. So it looks like they're interested in doing the same thing. Well, that's called an arms race, I think, isn't it?
That some new people will pay attention and come in to support our movement. Such is the case following the release of the film A House of Dynamite. Directed by Oscar winner Catherine Bigelow, the film follows three separate tracks of response to the same event, a nuclear missile launch of unknown origin on the United States. This taut thriller follows the same 18 minutes from detection to the unshown inevitable conclusion, and it does so from three perspectives, the White House Situation Room, the United States Strategic Command, and finally, the President himself. The film provides a platform for discussion of nuclear deterrence as not being able to deter or deflect an attack, and leaves us to consider if there are earlier steps that could have been taken to step back from the nightmare edge of nuclear possibility. Catherine Bigelow, who grew up during the Cold War and remembers those duck and cover exercises, said she wanted to remind audiences that, quote, our world is combustible, and that she's glad if people come away from the movie as concerned as she is. A House of Dynamite opened in movie theaters on October 10 and dropped on Netflix streaming on October 24th. It must be successful because it's already stirring up nuclear proponents to undercut it. The Pentagon in particular is unhappy with the film, which at one point has the defense secretaries claiming that current missile defenses have only a 50% chance of intercepting a missile despite their $50 billion with a B dollar price tag. In response, the Pentagon claimed that real-world testing, quote, tells a vastly different story from the events depicted, that the 50% claim is based on earlier prototypes, and that today's interceptors, quote, have displayed a 100% accuracy rate in testing for more than a decade, end quote. To which the movie screenwriter Noel Oppenheimer said to The Atlantic, that's based on data from controlled tests. So, you can imagine, Those are under the best of circumstances. As we mentioned in the movie, there are fewer than 50 of these ground-based intercepts in our arsenal. So even if it were working perfectly, there are not a ton of them that we have available to use. And a lot of the folks we talked to felt that 61% was being very generous when it comes to the system that we have. While it's true that the Pentagon was not consulted during the making of this movie, its credits reveal a long list of tech advisors who have worked in the Pentagon, at least some of whom were on set every day. And while the big media push now is on the director, the screenwriter, the Pentagon, and the like, Nuclear Hot Seat wanted to take a look at the grassroots and what this film might mean to activists on the ground who are fighting against nuclear proliferation and for peace. The first group to have jumped on the film as an organizing and consciousness-raising opportunity is the Los Alamos Study Group. Located in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and focused on Los Alamos, the birthplace of the atomic bomb, since 1989, LASG, as it is known, has worked on nuclear and energy policy research, environmental analysis, congressional education and lobbying, community organizing, litigation, and advertising. Now it's stepping up to take advantage of A House of Dynamite and the awareness it is creating about nuclear threats and dangers. LASG is led by Executive Director and Co-Founder Greg Mello, and I spoke with him on Monday, October 27, 2025. Greg Mello, it's always great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Libby.
Let's start out with some background information about the organization. What is the Los Alamos Study Group, and what is the focus of your work?
Well, we're a kind of think tank and action tank. We lobby, we litigate, we organize, we write, we try to be a clearinghouse for journalists on nuclear issues, specifically nuclear weapons issues. We've been doing this quite a while now, more than three decades.
While you are not specifically in Los Alamos, you are in what is arguably the belly of the beast, meaning that part of the world. Where are you located? And considering that Los Alamos, where the first atomic bombs were built and tested for the Manhattan Project, what do you know about the town's continuing involvement with the nuclear industry?
Well, we're located in Albuquerque. We have the two largest laboratories on either side of us, Sandia on one side, Los Alamos on the other, Los Alamos being the best funded nuclear weapons facility in the world. And down the street, we have Kirtland Air Force Base, where there are more nuclear weapons than anywhere else on the planet. So we're in a nuclear hot seat, as you might put it, right here.
I would assume that nuclear-related businesses are a major employer in the area. How hard has that made it through the years to continue as a group and to get your points across?
It has helped more than it has hurt. So businesses, by that we mean government contractors primarily, the two largest being Los Alamos and Sandia, which dominate the federal spending in the state, actually. They spend a lot of money. It's probably more than 10 times as concentrated a level of nuclear warhead spending as in any other state. So the politics are really dominated in the state by nuclear weapons. That means you can't count on our political leaders to help. That's for sure. They're on the other side. Yeah, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, they do everything they can to bring in the nuclear dollars. So we work around them.
And the media in your area, the newspapers, any broadcast outlets there might be, meaning traditional old style media, are they on your side? Are they impartial? Do they lean towards favoring pro-nuclear positions?
Well, they do increasingly favor nuclear positions because of the money and jobs, but they are capable of being outraged. And we have quite a lot of impacts from these industries in the state, which do make good news. It's not traditionally what you call nuclear news. Los Alamos has grown so much in the last five or so years that it has really put an enormous strain on the regional housing market, the road network, the labor markets. Everything is negatively impacted by the push to make new nuclear weapons pits or the cores, triggers, the Rocky Flats mission at Los Alamos. It's a new mission. It's gigantic. And the infrastructure of the region and its economic geography, its human geography, is not set up for that.
Let's move ahead, because we are right now having a moment, courtesy a movie, a Hollywood movie, The House of Dynamite by Catherine Bigelow, the director. Has it opened locally? And if so, what, if any, response or impact has there been so far? How long ago did it open?
It opened a little more than 2 weeks ago in one theater in New Mexico. I do not know how many people saw it. We saw it on the opening day, and there were four people there, three of them in our organization. Last night, we did the first of four planned screenings of our own, which we followed with a discussion, and we'll do the same on the other three, so that people will have a chance to look at this with others and parse some of what they've seen and see how it might apply and how they might be part of efforts to defuse the House of Dynamite.
Did you know about the film before it opened and what it addressed?
Yes, we knew. It was widely reviewed starting when it opened in Venice.
So having that little bit of advance notice on it, what, if any, plans and preparations did the Los Alamos Study Group make to take advantage of this media moment?
Well, we certainly let our closest volunteers as well as a larger mailing list know about it. We tried to get people to go to the commercial showings because of the excellent big screen, big sound, and we want them to come to our showings as well for the big discussion. And so, we did a fair bit of planning, and also we advertised. We put a double page advertisement in this past Wednesday's weekly paper in Santa Fe, the Santa Fe Reporter. It's a free weekly. It's out for a week. And we put a large advertisement that went for some of the local issues and as they relate to the movie. It's hard to do it all in one ad. So someone called it an infomercial. That's what we did.
I would look at it as an advertorial because it was extremely detailed. The talking points in particular that you pulled out were important, but I thought it was remarkable to have that much information. Just so that people know, the title on it was Greed, Not National Security, Drives LANLs, that stands for Los Alamos National Lab, LANLs, Failing Plutonium Bomb Factory. And it has the subtitle, LANLs Unnecessary Ultra Expensive Factory is Years Behind Schedule, Costs Are Six Times What Was Promised, Production Still MIA, Thankfully. Somebody reads that, they don't even have to read the article.
Yes, I'm glad that's what you got out of it. You could just read the headline and you get most of it. We have here this different situation than most people do because of the proximity we have to this facility and the ability to say no in a more powerful way because of that proximity. Pretty much everybody knows people who work at the labs, people who may or may not love what they do. They may feel trapped. We know the local political people. Like many medium-sized towns, the political elites are accessible to the public. And it's not quite as accessible as it used to be when you could regularly talk to your senators on the weekends at the farmer's market. But nonetheless, they're still relatively accessible. It's not like California. So it's important for people to have these details because it empowers them.
Has there been any kind of pushback against the film in Los Alamos? It's still early days, admittedly, but has anything come up where people are going, well, you can't say that, and that's wrong, and this is just Hollywood, and blah, blah, blah?
It is, like you said, early days, but I don't expect that. And in fact, a local digital newspaper took our press release in its entirety and put it on the top of their homepage for Wednesday night's screening in Los Alamos. So we were very grateful for that. It's excellent advertising for us. And so most people in Los Alamos will read the Los Alamos Daily Post.
Any pushback yet from the Chamber of Commerce, which is so keen to protect its jobs?
No, they're busy deciding what their gross receipts tax should be. And there's quite a debate about that. It's a course. And there is an interesting wrinkle in state law that manufacturing is not taxed. Well, manufacturing pits. And so they're afraid that part of Los Alamos's spending will be tax-free and they won't be able to draw a gross receipts tax from making nuclear weapons.
I'm making all kinds of faces over here because it's kind of like, yes, we're very concerned about nukes. We might not be able to tax them.
Yes, that's exactly right. So that's the debate going on. And tomorrow night, they're going to discuss this county council meeting. And this is what is being debated on the pages of the local blogs.
Not whether it's right or wrong, not whether they should proceed with it, not if maybe there are alternative pathways to take, nothing about the morality, nothing about the importance of where our money goes, but really how much money of the money that's there can we get is the nature of the debate.
Correct. But there's an issue just below the surface that will interest your listeners. And that is that 800 or 900 people per year quit the lab. And this is close to a crisis in that those people have to be replaced each year and trained. These are not mostly retirements of older Cold War workers. That wave has come and gone. These are primarily new workers who have been recruited by glossy advertising and great promises of everything that they promise, which is quite a lot. But the reality of work at this laboratory and in New Mexico does not meet the expectations of hundreds of people every year. Whether the morality is involved, yes, it is involved to some degree, a degree we don't fully understand. Quality of life issues are involved because Los Alamos Laboratory has so poisoned the environment, the social environment I'm talking about, the economic environment, that New Mexico is now the worst state in which to raise a child. It has the worst educational system in the country. It is difficult to find a doctor because physicians are leaving. Among the 50 states, it's kind of a basket case. And people who may come from a more functional situation can be shocked when they arrive. And so underlying the issues about traffic congestion, which is severe, the labor market, the unaffordable housing, this problem of employee retention. And this, as it turns out, is most severe at Los Alamos, but it also is an issue across the nuclear weapons industry. It is an enormous point of vulnerability for peace activists. It is time that we started to have more dialogue with the people who are just like us, who are working in the fields of the bomb. And the movie does provide a way to begin talking about this and a way to begin talking about it also with young people. We think it's fabulously educational.
In the advertorial or opinion piece or advertisement, whatever you want to call it, that Los Alamos Study Group took out, you said that the National Nuclear Security Agency's poorly conceived pit experiment at LANL is fragile. That's not a word, fragile, that I would expect to ever see in conjunction with anything nuclear. What did you mean by that?
I meant that their previous plans have failed, and this one appears to be failing as well. They're fighting against factual circumstances that make it difficult to succeed. The manager of this program at Los Alamos once likened it, not so long ago, a couple of years ago, to overhauling an airplane while in flight with passengers aboard. That's fragile. It's a difficult thing to retool an active plutonium facility while there are people working in it on about six different programs, which can't be halted. So the way they're doing this is at the end of the day shift, they erect temporary barriers, they're scaffolding if they need it. The way they're trying to do this is to work 24/7 and do their construction and equipment installation in the middle of the night, which entails a lot of setup and a lot of cleaning up. That's dangerous. Most of the workers don't have the right kind of security clearance, so they need to be accompanied by armed guards. So the whole process is very slow and painful, and it's taking years. It will take 6 years minimum beyond what they said it would take. And it's, like I said, it's going to cost about six times as much, assuming they are successful at all. The military as a whole, the nuclear weapons complex, the contractors project an image of confidence across the board. But the technical problems, the managerial problems, institutional problems, human problems are always worse than are represented when the contract is given. And at Los Alamos National Laboratory, the culture is such that the problems are really underestimated.
Is there any kind of a forum or a format or a hotline for workers at Los Alamos to be able to say, we have a problem here, I'm concerned about something, where it's information that you might have access to and be able to then turn around and do something with?
If they are tough-minded, they may call us or they may call a reporter. The New York Times has put up little notices around town asking for whistleblowers to come forward because there are these situations. To avoid this, the primary contractor is going slow, and they're trying to be safe. It's partly because they actually do care about the workers, but they also care about bad publicity.
So you have already had your first evening where the film was shown and there was a discussion afterwards. That was Sunday, October 26th. Interestingly, at the Santa Fe Friends meeting, which is the Quakers, I'm very fond of the Quakers these days, because of the Westheimer Peace Symposium and the Peace Resource Center at Wilmington College. Did people show up for the screening and did they stick around for the discussion afterwards, or were they so overwhelmed they just fled with their hands over their ears to go to the nearest bar?
Yes, there was a discussion afterwards. I need to say that the Los Alamos Study Group, in its initial incarnation, was a project of the Santa Fe Friends Meeting. That is, some members of Friends Meeting were among our initial group, and we put our bank account there. And so our natality was within them. But, you know, that was a long time ago. So they co-hosted this, and they have a beautiful setup there for viewing the film. So technically, it was very smooth and comfortable. About a third of the people left after the film, and two-thirds stayed. We had a good discussion. You know, these days, our society is very atomized. So there were, almost everyone is in left field.
What do you mean by they're in left field?
There's no strong unifying culture that draws people together. And so it is important for us to get together and talk and listen to different perspectives. And they were very different. If you go online, you will see very different perspectives about the movie. And some of that we had as well. Pretty much everybody was some stripe of political left, anti-nuclear. So we unfortunately did not have people on the political right, but that was Santa Fe. I expect on Wednesday in Los Alamos, we certainly will.
Moving forward, what do you hope the impact of the film is going to be, House of Dynamite, on the general public? And how are you hoping for this film to change things?
I think it's entirely up to we and our separate various organizations, whether they are religious or anti-nuclear or interested in political reform more broadly, because of the film by itself is not going to have any lasting impact. It's we who will create the lasting impact by what we do with the film. We hope that some of our more active people will help us use this in an educational setting, will amplify what we're able to do from our tiny office. But barring that, it's going to slip between the waves because we have an ongoing tsunami of crises in this country, right?
Have you been in conversation with any other activists or activist groups who have seen what you're doing and going, yowza, we need to get on this, or here's what we are doing, have you thought of this? Has there been any kind of brainstorming between the groups?
There were a couple of activist groups there, maybe three, four, last night. Some stayed for the discussion, so we had some indication of what they were going to do, but it's early days.
Well, as you and the others come up with further plans for what to do with this film, because the fact that it just dropped on Netflix and it is already one of the top 10 showing up there shows that there's a tremendous amount of interest. How we harness that interest is what is going to determine whether we make an appreciable difference in at least the conversation around nukes, if not actively turn things around and start moving in the opposite direction to not make the pits, to not put the money there, which is going to be difficult to pull off. But if we all participate, if we all work in it and on it, there's a chance we might be able to make some differences. And I will take small differences, because if we can't affect a large one, which it looks like we can't, let's just take the little teeny tiny ones one at a time and add them up.
Yes. I want to go back.
From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style, is the title of a new.
Oh, that was a lousy edit from Nuclear Hot Seat with Libby Halevy interviewing a chap from a Los Alamos study group. They're more than just a study group. They're an activist group. And they're talking about the Oscar-winning director Kathryn Bigelow's House of Dynamite, which dramatizes an attack on the U.S. with a nuclear weapon, as you might have heard from the beginning. House of Dynamite at Nuclear Hot Seat. I hadn't even heard about the show. So, opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others. The cross and the flag and the cross was something else I was going to try to cover. So at least I'll mention it. It's a new book by interesting group of socialists talking about the authoritarianism that's happening in the U.S. Just a moment to play an underwriting announcement. I guess I did an disclaimer. Here's a legal ID. This is WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, 90.1 FM on your radio dial, on your app, on your computer. Thanks for tuning in to support community media.